Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk with scholars and librarians about books, ideas, and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. I'm delighted this week to have in our program a scholar and a librarian, the historian Robert Darnton, university professor and university librarian at Harvard University. He is an authority on the social and cultural history of 18th century France, and it wouldn't be an exaggeration to say he's one of the early proponents and practitioners of cultural history. That is a way of doing history that draws on anthropological as well as historical methods to look at popular cultural traditions in order to gain insight into historical experience. He's also a motive force behind the Digital Public Library of America, about which we're going to devote our program next week. He is a 2011 recipient of the National Humanities Medal, bestowed on him by President Obama for his service on behalf of making knowledge publicly accessible, what Walt Whitman once called cultural democracy. He's talking with us today by telephone about his book, Poetry and the Police, Communication Networks in 18th Century Paris, published by Harvard University Press in 2010. Hello, Bob.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
You were a reporter for the New York Times at one time, and does that influence the way you do history and the fact that your books are so accessible, really literary works, many of them?
Well, people often ask me, did my time as a journalist influence the way I understand and write history? It certainly did, but I don't know to what extent.
Mm-hmm.
I do archival history, basically. I love to bury myself in the archives and pore over dossiers where you make surprising discoveries. Nothing could seem further from journalism than that, although I've often found that when I open up a dossier that no one has seen for 200 or 300 years,
mm-hmm.
I'm really behaving like a detective. I pick up a line of inquiry and then follow leads until I reach not some kind of bottom line, because I don't think history has bottom lines, but until I get to a point where I feel I've understood what is actually going on in these lives lived so long ago. Also, the kind of journalism I did was very street-level journalism.
Yeah.
I spent almost all of my time in police headquarters, first actually when I worked for the Newark Star-Ledger way back in 1958. Newark was a very tough town and...
Still is.
You know, well, it's not an easy place. This was before the great Newark riots,
yeah.
But there was lots of crime. And crime stories really were what interested the editors most. And the saying was, if you can cover police headquarters, you can cover the White House, which tells us, I think, something about people's attitude toward the White House. But in any case, the idea was that you had to get the story right, you had to develop a sense of a story, you had to write rapidly and clearly, and also that you shouldn't condescend toward your readers. I think that journalism, certainly as I later experienced it on the New York Times, working in the London Bureau and then in the City Room in Manhattan, that kind of journalism requires you to respect your readers.
Mm-hmm.
And what I try to do in my history writing is to not write down to them and yet to get across something that is really innovative, if not avant-garde. So that's not easy. That is to say, to combine the kind of rigor and research and conceptual problems with a way of writing that should be fun for readers. So I really believe history should be fun, not in some trivial sense, but in the sense of giving pleasure and a sense of fulfillment.
You're quite an early proponent for cultural history, and at the very least, you helped to shape the field by sorting out what it was and what it wasn't in terms of its relation to other ways of doing history. And I'm thinking here of your collection of essays, especially in the book The Kiss of Lamourette. And also, you were, along with D.F. McKenzie and a small handful of other people, a very early advocate for the history of the book. And both of these types of inquiry have become mainstream. You know, cultural history is almost synonymous with history itself now, way, we do history. And the history of the book has become very quickly a rich and vital field of specialization, you know, witnessed by many of the guests I have on the show every week, including Harvard's own Ann Blair and Leah Price. And this book, like most of your research, focuses on communication. And I wonder, is there something about communication media that makes it an important focus for someone doing cultural history or a rich vein of inquiry, particularly? Do the two go together somehow, doing cultural history and having an interest in media?
Well, yes. I mean, I do believe that human beings are animals who communicate. We know that other animals communicate in various ways, but we have symbolic modes of expression that bring us together and that operate at the heart of society. So just on the face of it, I think that the study of communication really is central to understanding the human condition in general. That sounds awfully abstract, but when you get into the details and study the way it actually happens, it becomes endlessly fascinating. So I've tried to study modes of communication, whether they're written or printed or oral, whether they're sung, or even if they go on inside someone's head and then are somehow sensed by other people. There's a great deal of that. So, yes, and furthermore, you know, you hear every day now, we live in the information age, as if other ages didn't have information. I mean, of course they did, but because we today see communication, especially internet-type exchange, as central to the kind of society we live in, I think that alerts us to the importance of communication in the past. So a general history of communication, I mean, it's not the sort of thing I believe that is going to lend itself to writing a multi-volume overview, a general sort of history.
Yeah.
It's a kind of history that lends itself to, well, what I call detective work, case studies, this sort of investigation that helps the modern reader make contact with people in the past, people who are not all that different, but lived in different mental worlds. And that kind of contact, I think, is exhilarating.
Yeah, so it's historical experience, in a sense, that you're after, at least in part, you know, mentalities, attitudes. Although, you know, I know those things can never really be captured in a positivistic way. It seems to be that's what your books have to offer.
Yes, I mean, that's what I'm aiming to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, if we talk about attitudes or worldviews, it sounds awfully abstract and almost gaseous, you know, something floating above Earth and so on. And I actually believe that, of course, everyone has a set of attitudes, a value system. You can't actually make your way in the world without being oriented in some fashion or other. And so there are individual and collective attitudes that really do exist and that are as real as economic activity. So despite the abstract sound of doing a study of attitudes and views of the world and value systems, the sorts of things that anthropologists explicitly cite as their goals, despite that seemingly abstract quality, it's actually something that's close to the lives of everyone.
So in this particular case, in Poetry and the Police, you're writing on a mode of communication here, but it's a mode of communication that isn't ordinarily written down. I mean, you're talking here about popular songs and renditions of popular songs that are always changing and that may have been written down on scraps of paper to be memorized, but ordinarily this is a means of oral communication. So how did you come to set yourself this task? Was it just a sort of personal challenge that you wanted to try to do something impossible, or did the evidence sort of entice you?
Well, you know, I found in general in doing research that I write about something I wasn't originally intending to do. I mean, I never set the goal for myself, let's do oral history and understand how word of mouth actually traveled and operated. What really happened was I was working in the archives in the Bibliothèque de l'Arsenal, which is in the center of Paris, and I was looking for something else, for information on a particular political problem. And I was just going through boxes of manuscripts. Well, most people don't know what the experience is like, but if you go to the archives, you fill out bulletin with the right number of a box where you hope you will find something interesting. The box arrives. Mm-hmm. You untie a little sort of faded ribbon on the side and fold back the top, and there are a pile of dossiers. And you begin probably with the first one and just start reading. So I was doing this, working through dozens of boxes, and I came across one dossier that said, The Affair of the 14. I thought, I never heard of this. What could it possibly be? And so it was a thick dossier, and I started reading, and I realized that I was reading the investigation of the police trying to track oral communication. Mm-hmm. This is simply amazing. I mean, here's a run of manuscript that's going to take us to the heart of a problem that has always eluded historians because, as you said, most oral communication simply gets lost in the air. In this case, though, it began with a fascinating assignment. The head of the police in Paris, who is a very powerful man, something like the Minister of the Interior, he received an order from the king saying, this was through a minister, find the author of the poem that begins with this line, Monster Whose Dark Fury. That's all they knew. That was the only clue, but they knew it was serious because the king himself took an interest in it. Mm. So they had to find somehow the author of this poem that they didn't know. But according to some estimates, the police had as many as 3,000 spies. They were called mouches for flies because they buzzed around cafes and public gardens and open spaces in Paris trying to pick up compromising information and actually just to provide the police with reports about what we today would call public opinion. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, one of these spies, after a couple of weeks, sent in a little piece of paper. It had, I think, just two sentences on it. It was in this box of documents that I found. And it said, he's found someone who has the poem, and he can give the name and the information if the police desired it. Well, the police sure did desire it. The reward was 10 louis d'or, which was about the equivalent of a year's salary for an unskilled laborer, a lot of money. And the police promptly arrested this person. They had techniques of doing the arrest, which I also found fascinating. Mm-hmm. You know, they would have a coach kept ready around a corner where it couldn't be seen, and then they would approach the future prisoner, the victim, mm-hmm. a law student, actually, whose name was François Bonis. And they invented a story saying, oh, the Maréchal de Noailles, a very important person who looked after dueling and quarrels, wanted to see him about a certain affair of honor. Wouldn't he follow them into this coach? Well, he knew that he hadn't been involved in any duels, so he said, okay. He stepped into the coach, and a few minutes later, he was in the Bastille being interrogated. Now, the interrogations are fascinating documents because they're done very carefully and always in the question-answer format. So you get the question, the answer, question, answer, question, answer. The prisoner signs his name at the bottom of each page to verify for their accuracy. And the police, in questioning people, were really always after information about their collaborators and the background to things.
Yeah. Sounds very modern in terms of methodology, doesn't it? I mean, if they'd had tape recorders, I suppose they'd have used them. But
well, you know, they're remarkably thorough documents, mm-hmm. and they're fun because reading them is like listening to a dialogue. And in this case, they warned Bonis that if he didn't tell them where he got the poem, they would treat him as its author. And by the way, there was an iron cage hanging in the Mont Saint-Michel where you could put a prisoner. He couldn't stand up or lie down in it. He just had to remain crouched. And it was said that men, when they were trapped in it for more than a few weeks, would go mad. So Bonis promptly said, oh, no, I didn't write it. I got it from a priest called Edouard. He gave the information about, you know, where Edouard actually let him copy the poem. Edouard is arrested the next day. He got it from another priest. he's arrested, and so on, down a line, really a line of communication. But when they got to the fifth or sixth person, that person said, yes, I got the poem from X, but I also got three other poems from Y. And so Y is arrested, and before the police know it, they're on the trail of six poems and songs, one more seditious than the other. And so if you read your way through all of the interrogations, pretty soon what you are seeing is a network through which messages are being passed. And they're being passed by some students who memorized the poems. The art of memory was highly developed then.
Mm-hmm.
By people who wrote them down on little scraps of paper and carried them around in their pockets. And I found lots of these scraps of paper. But especially by people who sung them. And that I found particularly interesting because it never occurred to me that songs were as important as they clearly were once you began following the police on their rounds. At this time, Paris didn't have real newspapers, that is, papers with news in it about politics and power.
Yeah.
So where did people get their information? Well, they got a lot of it from songs. Paris was just full of songs, and if you could walk into 18th century Paris, you couldn't walk a block without hearing somebody singing. There were sort of beggars and professional singers on street corners. People sang at work. The air is simply full of songs, and the interesting thing is that the songs are always to a set number of tunes.
Mm-hmm.
So people carried in their heads certain popular tunes, and then they improvised new words to the old tunes. And I believe that tunes, they're usually quite simple, are extraordinary mnemonic devices, ways to remember things, so that if you can have a good new verse to a catchy tune, it simply spreads like wildfire.
Sure, I remember, I think, just about all the lyrics for, the top 20 from about 1964 to about 1969 that, we heard on the radio, without even trying. It's something about music.
Exactly. That, yeah. My own head is full of lots of commercials, sung commercials.
Jingles, yes.
In fact, if you like, I can give you an example.
Sure, yeah.
Well, I don't know if you know this. I don't believe it exists anymore, but I think everyone of my age has this in his or her head. Pepsi-Cola hits the spot, 12 full ounces, that's a lot, twice as much and better too. Pepsi-Cola is a drink for you. But one day when I think I was in second grade or third grade, a wise guy appeared in the playground, and he sang this version of that tune. Christianity hits the spot, 12 apostles, that's a lot. Holy Ghost and a virgin too, Christianity's a thing for you. And, I was shocked. The first time I'd ever heard irreligion.
Uh-huh.
And it stuck with me and with all the other kids on the playground because there's a sticking power to parodies of songs that everyone knows by heart.
Yeah. Knowing the original song adds something to the altered song then, doesn't it?
It does, and that's one of the problems I try to address in my research, because people collected these songs. They heard a new verse, they would write it down on a scrap of paper, paste the scrap of paper into a kind of scrapbook. These scrapbooks were called chansonniers, or collections of songs, and I read literally hundreds of them. One of them, which was from the mid-18th century, around 1745, had 641 songs in it, just in one of these scrapbooks. They're all over the place, but they always say, sung to the tune of, and then they give the name of the tune, but I'd never heard of any of these tunes, and no one I knew had ever heard of them.
Yeah.
La béquille du père Barnabas, that was one, I wanted to know what it actually sounded like. So fortunately, in the musicology section of the National Library in Paris, they have keys to songs. And so you can look up the title of a song or the first line in a song and then get the musical annotation. Well, that was marvelous because it was then going to be possible to capture the sound And a friend of mine, Hélène Delaveau, who is a cabaret performer in Paris and a wonderful singer, agreed to record the songs. Mm-hmm. And so there is an online accompaniment to my book, Poetry and the Police, in which the reader can take the book and read an appendix where I give the words of the songs in the original French and translated.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, the reader can listen to Hélène singing them, and it's as if you can hear the past.
Yes, and I can post the URL for Hélène Delaveau's website on our website at library-cafe.org so our listeners can access it. And I thought I might play the three versions she does of the one song that had certainly consequences for the government, Réveillez-vous, Belle Dormeuse, and then perhaps you could comment on the three versions.
Yes.
So here's the first version.
Réveillez-vous, belle dormeuse, si mes discours vous font plaisir, mais si vous êtes scrupuleuse, dormez ou feignez de dormir.
So can you tell us about the original version?
Sure, the original version, it's a very popular, rather lyrical and totally innocent song that everyone knew.
And so next up is the first parody, which is apolitical. And this is a song that ends with a swarm of bats.
That's right. So it compares an aristocratic lady at court. She's someone who's followed by a swarm of bats. So it takes this beautiful lyrical popular tune and verse and transforms it into a satire, but it's just a satire aimed at a particular courtier.
Yeah.
Sur vos pas charmantes duchesses, au lieu des grâces et des ris, l'amour fait voltiger sans cesse un essaim de chauve-souris.
And then finally there's this version, which is the one that seems to have got the king's attention.
Par vos façons nobles et franches, Iris vous enchantez nos cœurs, sur nos pas vous semez des fleurs, mais ce sont des fleurs blanches.
This political parody of this very popular song was enormously important and deeply shocking. Mm-hmm. It was so shocking that, believe it or not, it brought down the government. Now, that sounds extravagant and maybe a little crazy, but actually, all of the contemporary evidence agrees.
Yeah.
The government that fell was the government of the Comte de Maurepas. He was the most powerful minister and had served for more than 30 years in various capacities under Louis XV. He called the tune, so to speak, and that's quite appropriate for what did him in, because this particular song says in English, "With your noble and frank manner, Iris, you enchant our hearts. On our path you scatter flowers, but they are only white flowers." Now, to most readers today, that would sound totally innocent.
Yeah,
but in fact, it referred to an actual scene that took place in Versailles in the so-called petits appartements, the private quarters of the king where he could relax and not be trapped in this world of ceremony that was so unpleasant for him. He had a dinner party with Madame de Pompadour, her cousin, and the Count of Maurepas, this leading minister, just four of them. Madame de Pompadour at this dinner gave some white hyacinths as a kind of gallant gesture to the others during the dinner party. And that's what is alluded to in the line, "But they are only white flowers." However, the courtiers instantly recognized a play on words. Mm. Fleur blanche is fleur blanche, or it's a term for a kind of venereal disease that is discharged in menstruation. The song actually says Madame de Pompadour is giving the king VD. That was too much.
Too much, yeah.
And it was attributed to Maurepas because the king believed that only Maurepas knew about this particular dinner party.
Yeah.
This can sound like very trivial history, but actually the fall of Maurepas was a turning point in the power structure of the court at this time. There were various factions, and I go into the rivalries and so on. I mean, most people today might not be interested in that, but the point is that pressure was building up, and the anti-Maurepas faction, which was aligned with Madame de Pompadour, used this song finally to tip the balance and so enrage the king that he got rid of Maurepas. And as I say, this was one of the most important and dramatic moments in the peculiar political history of 18th century France, because the political system was a court system, and it was in the court that power was located. And this song is cited in all of the diaries and the letters exchanged at the time as an example of the power of the sung word to actually unseat a minister.
Does public opinion enter into this as a real kind of political power in itself? You know, we're still a few decades here before the French Revolution. And I wonder, is there a real danger in these songs perceived either by the court or by the police? Or are they really a tool that people on the inside are using to, you know, that's not the way I want to put this, but, you know.
I think you put it very well. Mm-hmm. That is to say, are we talking about a kind of intrigue that just concerns the small world of courtiers in the power system of Versailles?
Yes.
Or does this also include this mysterious something that we call public opinion that's spread everywhere? That's one of the main general issues that I try to address in the book. I mean, certainly one can prove that this did involve court politics just in the way I explain, but did it spill over beyond that? Well, without being able to produce or pull out of my pocket some definition of public opinion, I do think that that phrase, public opinion, describes the set of attitudes and the way messages, mobilized attitudes, certainly in Paris and really throughout the provinces. How can one demonstrate that? Well, not easy, although, again, there are lots of diaries and letters exchanged at this time, which say they don't quite use public opinion, but they'll talk about the state of spirit of the public, that kind of thing.
Obviously, it was of enough interest to create and cultivate a secret police.
Exactly. I mean, that's why, of course, this police expedition took place, because it mattered to the king himself what people were saying about him. And there is correspondence in these various dossiers I read through saying that the head of the police actually went to Versailles and reported to Louis XV about the arrest of this first person who was just a 21-year-old law student, someone without any importance at all. And he said the king took a very intense interest in the affair. So the police is always providing reports on what people are saying in cafes, in taverns, in public gardens. And does this mean that the monarch himself in some way feels responsible to public opinion or constrained by it?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so, frankly. I'm not sure exactly what the attitude on the part of the king was.
Well, Louis XV was certainly an absolutist monarch, if ever
well,
there
was
one. Yeah.
Certainly in theory, but then there were all sorts of constraints on his power.
Yeah.
You know, there were riots frequently when the price of bread spun out of control or new taxes were slapped on the Parisians and also provincials. There were law courts called parliaments that had considerable power to block royal legislation, which had to be registered in a particular way. There was the church. There was the nobility. There were intermediary corps, as Tocqueville called them, bodies that through which power was channeled. So it's not as if the king could just say, off with your head, and all the heads fell, but rather there were lots of different constraints. And I think that public opinion was one of them. But in saying this, I'm disagreeing with some other historians and the famous sociologist Jürgen Habermas, who talks about the public sphere as something that only began to emerge in the late 18th century and that concerned rational ideas and the discussion of them. I think that we had a public sphere that concerned the common people, and the way they expressed themselves, it was certainly not in the form of rational discourse, but rather witticisms, kind of dirty jokes, if you like, and music. So it's all taking place, but is it causing the French Revolution? Well,
yeah.
You know, the French Revolution had so many causes that I would hate to add another one to it. Yeah. And one of the nice things, the fascinating things about studying this is to try to reconstruct an information system as it actually operated, but without trying to trace some line of causality that's going to take us to the Great Explosion in 1789.
Sure. You give a nice example of one of the sort of concerns of the day, and that had to do with the person we know in the English world as Bonnie Prince Charlie of Scotland. I wonder if you could talk about that, because it does say something about the fact that this isn't a revolutionary mentality at this point, behind much of the spleen in these songs.
Yes, I don't think it is a revolutionary mentality. I think it's much older than that, something that you might associate with the uprising known as the Fronde in 1648, or even a lot of Renaissance street politics and court politics. But certainly Bonnie Prince Charlie was a very, very evocative figure in Paris. The Parisians cast him as a hero because when he went to Scotland in 1745 and stirred up a rebellion, that tried to march on London and take over the English throne, claiming that he was the rightful heir to the throne as a Stuart. He was called the Young Pretender in England. When he did this, it was spectacularly interesting and even, if you want, for lack of a better word, romantic. You know, this young man with his cause, trying to overthrow perfidious Albion, because the French and the English were constantly at war. And he did it as part of a war, part of the War of the Austrian Succession from 1740 to 1748. Of course, as we know, he failed miserably. He was almost caught by the English and escaped back to France. But then he a terrific figure in Paris because everyone admired his daring attempt, and he really became quite a public figure. He would go to the opera surrounded by his Scottish Jacobite followers, and people are again writing songs about him and so on. But when the peace treaty, the Treaty of Aix-la-Chapelle, was negotiated, the English insisted that the French expel Bonnie Prince Charlie from France and that they cease to recognize him as the rightful king of Britain. This was awkward because how do you get rid of this person who's walking around in Paris, exciting the admiration of the Parisians? Well, the way it was done is what was so shocking to public opinion. He was about to enter the opera when he was grabbed, handcuffed, thrown into a carriage, hustled out of Paris. The streets had been lined with soldiers along the route that the carriage took. He was, so to speak, kidnapped, and the story of his kidnapping filled the songs and the poems at the time because the Parisians contrasted this heroic, brave, and rather dashing young man who is willing to go to battle for his throne with Louis XV, who just luxuriated with his royal mistresses and his grand ceremonies in Versailles all the time, losing battles and losing the respect of people. So the affair of Bonnie Prince Charlie epitomized France's position in the European power system and its failure to gain any ground in the War of the Austrian Succession, its acceptance of a peace treaty that was a humiliation for France and that the Parisians in particular detested. So you've got lots of information in the songs and the poems about the peace treaty itself. It's a kind of running discourse on current events as developed in the streets of Paris. That's what I mean when I say people were interested in public affairs, and there was an outlet for them, not in newspapers, but in things like street songs.
It's interesting, the suggestion here is that Louis XV isn't royal enough. He's not a king like Bonnie Prince Charlie's a king.
Yeah, or like Louis XIV. So yes, none of the songs are saying we should have a republic and overthrow the king.
Yeah.
What they are saying is the monarchy is decadent and despotic and really despicable.
Yeah. Do you have a sense that France is a special case here with this kind of communication? And does it have anything to do with the fact that there aren't any newspapers at this point in France? I mean, Germany has newspapers, England has newspapers.
I agree that it exists in different ways and different times
yeah.
Different places. But certainly England at this time has a very active journalistic political culture. And this is just before the Wilkes affairs of the 1760s, when you've got really violent journalism, pamphlets,
yeah.
Street agitation, all sorts of agitation that is a challenge to the status quo, and that when the French observed it, as I've read the dispatches of the French ambassadors, they say, you know, this country is spinning out of control. They could have another revolution. Of course, they had one in 1640 and another in 1688, and the French see this powerful system of information, the kind of testatory journalism, as peculiar to the English. But meanwhile, back in Paris, something like it was going on. In the case of Germany, which I've studied some, you got the famous Flugschriften of the 16th century, which were pamphlets at the time of the Lutheran movement that spread everywhere.
Yeah.
And for me, the best example, and the one where I see this tendency in early modern history beginning, has to do with Aretino in the early 17th century, late 16th century in Rome. Aretino was actually the son of a shoemaker, someone from very modest origins, but a terrific wit, and he could compose sonnets on anything. Well, especially like composing sonnets at the time of a papal election, and he would paste copies of them on a bust of a person called Pasquino. No one knew who Pasquino was, but it became a sort of bulletin board for Italians to put up satire. And so the Pasquinade developed out of this, and the French talked about modern Aretinos. L'Aretin moderne is the title of a best-selling book. And so you've got an Italian version of this, which mocks people, in this case cardinals, who are candidates for the papacy, mocks people and destroys their face, so to speak, what the Italians call the bella figura, that is, their reputation, their dignity, and a lot of power is attached to that. So I think that we can see, going back in time, a whole tradition of mockery, wit, and mudslinging that actually did represent a form of power.
Is there evidence that these songs were received differently by different groups of people or classes of people? You mentioned that some of the 14 were students and clerics. Would the songs have meant something different to them than they might have meant to people at court? You know, were they intending to bring the ire of people at court, or was it something akin to what the British do with their tabloids and the royal family, just a way of imagining real or imagined foibles of people living on another level?
Well, you know, if you read the interrogations of the 14 in the Bastille,
yeah.
They're simply amazed that they've been arrested. I mean, they thought they hadn't done anything wrong.
Yeah.
Of course, you could say they're simply trying to defend themselves. But basically, they say people have done this all the time. I mean, and in fact, it does look like a kind of late adolescent prank in many cases.
Yeah.
I did a study of the background of each of the 14, and they are students, young priests, some clerks in notary offices. So they belong to a particular milieu. But then the songs, of course, spread way beyond that, and they're picked up in taverns and in the street by simply anyone. So that is a world, I think, in which there are different levels and in which the meaning of the song could have varied. So myself, I take messages as being multivocal in general, that it, any kind of symbolic expression can mean different things to different people. Certainly, the meaning at the street level was quite different from that at the court.
Yeah. There's something wonderfully comic about it all, isn't there? And especially if you imagine it getting under the skin of people at the court, including the king himself.
Yeah, it's very funny. I mean, also the wit of these songs is terrific. And their ability to combine sound and inflections of sound with wit. The sound, of course, in the case of a particular verse, can convey oral memories about other verses that had been written to the same tune. And so you've got a kind of oral palimpsest that builds up as people have chains of association that reach back through current events.
Yeah.
And so I think it actually could be quite complex and required a lot of skill in performing and interpreting verses.
Yeah. Your book suggests all kinds of resonances for me between these 18th century Paris songs and 21st century social media, you know, not to mention politics. And, you know, I've been reading my own Facebook page post after post, for instance, where acquaintances transmit news and express anger and indignation concerning events that affect us, you know, affect them, over which we all seem to have less and less control. We might not have a Madame Pompadour, you know, but we do have the Koch brothers on whom to vent our spleen and dismay, depending on, I suppose, whose Facebook feed you're looking at. But although the internet is, for most of us in any case, at the moment, a fairly safe medium for expressing our opinions, the NSA seems to have a surveillance mechanism in place that would make the Comte d'Argenson green with envy if ever we did move into a society where censorship of opinion was in place. So do you find yourself thinking these same thoughts when you consider these songs?
Well, I do think that people often feel disenfranchised and powerless today.
Mm-hmm.
It's as if the world of Washington has become more and more remote, and certainly it's become more and more despised. Now, that's not altogether from Versailles, outside of Paris, becoming a world that seems to spin on its own and to monopolize power and play games according to its own rules without any concern for what's going on outside it.
Yeah.
Now, this is a caricature of things. Of course, people elect representatives and they participate in local and state levels in public life. However, I think there is a sense of frustration that builds up, and blogs, tweets, and so on provide an outlet for it. So this phenomenon of people sounding off about the rich, the powerful in some remote world where politics takes place, I think this is a phenomenon that you can find in many times and places across history. And certainly there is a feeling, I think a lot of people are convinced, that the NSA actually taps directly into not just the cell phone exchanges, but all of the information that flows through Google's system and Facebook system and so on.
Comments,
so that the information being stored in these huge farms of cloud-stored data, this information is just staggering in its depth and extent, something that the Comte d'Argenson would have absolutely admired.
Along these same lines, your discussion of the two philosophies of public opinion in the book I found really fascinating. You know, one that posits that discourse, all discourse, is a good in itself and eventually will lead to enlightenment and rational progress, and the other that it's a little dimmer view that public opinion isn't really a court of reason at all, but it can be a kind of leviathan that's easily manipulated. And of course, in the academy, we're in the discourse business, ideally, you know, the keepers of the flame of public reason. So the question that comes to mind is, do you have faith in discourse yourself still, you know, especially in forms of popular discourse, whatever the medium they assume? And I find myself asking this question, I suppose, because in the academy, you know, we are moated off still to some extent. We have our own way of looking at things, and we have faith in education, certainly. We have to have, because that's what we do. But I find myself sometimes wondering if reason is getting through the wall. And I wonder then, do you have faith in discourse yourself? I mean, are you an optimist about the fact that if people just do communicate, sooner or later things will get better?
Well, I've just completed a book about censorship.
Mm-hmm.
And doing this, I've spent long, long hours in the papers of the Communist Party of what was once the German Democratic Republic, the East Germany. If you've actually got inside a totalitarian system, you really get the shudders. You really feel as though you are looking into something truly black,
yeah,
where the state is all-powerful and comes down hard on anyone who dares publicly to make certain kinds of statements. And I saw that happening again and again. So I'm so impressed with the bravery of people who speak up in such systems and also the brutality of their repression, that when I look back on our lives in this comfortable world of universities, I really see a world of difference. What does worry me, as just speaking now as a professor, is the way we sometimes just talk to ourselves, to other professors, and fail to reach out and make contact with the general citizenry.
Yeah.
I feel that's part of our job. Now, I don't mean that we should be standing on soapboxes and giving political orations, but I think that we should do a better job of communicating ourselves concerning things that we do know about and that could interest the general public. So the noise level of beefing about the government, I think, is something that has always existed and will always exist. But at the same time, there's a need for serious concern about serious things, such as the polarization of society that is leaving us now in a world where we've got a very small number of the very, very rich who control a great deal of the economy, as opposed to the poor who really are getting poorer. Well, as a historian, I don't feel that I've got anything to say to the general public about that. I'm a citizen like everyone else. But I think I can talk a little bit about societies in the past where the distribution of wealth and power and prestige has been catastrophic and has led to catastrophic results. So in short, I don't believe that history teaches lessons. So I'm not trying to say, you know, we're in the edge of a revolution or something.
Yeah.
But I think what history can do is to give people a sense of perspective, that Americans tend to be so present-oriented that they don't realize that issues concerning flow of information and the way it inflects power, that these issues have always existed and that we can learn a lot about them through historical study.
Sure. You know, you mentioned in the book, and we were talking earlier about how much history is like detective work. And it reminded me, I used to be a fan of Barry Levinson's television police drama, Homicide. And there was a character on that who, as a pastime, was obsessed with trying to ferret out what happened with the Lincoln assassination. You know, he was a sort of amateur historian. He'd go home and he'd have a storyboard on the wall, like the storyboard in the office at work, and he had characters from the 19th century, 1860s, up on the board with lines connecting them. As you do in your book here, actually, you got a storyboard of your own. It looks like a detective police drama storyboard. And it used to occur to me, you mentioned Collingwood in the book, R.G. Collingwood, the historiographer,
yes,
that he makes a connection between history and detective work, that history is like detective work is the case he makes. But I wonder if it works the other way, too, that detective work is like history, and that the interest we all have in police drama, if it doesn't derive from an impulse to history, you know, to understanding who we are by looking at who we were. So that, I suppose, what I'm trying to say here is that one can make a case that history does something that fulfills a need in us all. It's not just something for historians.
I think there is a need. There's a need for contact with the past, a sense of what are my roots, where did I come from, where did we all come from?
Yeah, and exactly, yeah.
That's accompanied, I think, by skepticism about facile stories.
Yes.
That what we, the professional historians, can provide is rigor. And that's where Collingwood comes in, because Collingwood's notion of the historian as detective is not just a metaphor. I think he means it seriously as a way of understanding how we know what we know. It's, if you like, it sounds heavy going as a term, but it's epistemological.
Yeah.
And the thing about a mystery story is it has a solution. There are a set of clues. You can reconstruct lines of causality. and come up with an answer. Now, as I was saying earlier, I don't think there are bottom lines in history,
no.
But I do believe it's possible to be rigorous in reconstructing aspects of the past. So the Collingwood type of impulse, which is you don't just casually recount anecdotes, but you use them in a manner that is going to solve a problem, if not a murder,
yeah.
And use them rigorously in that respect, and therefore come close to the truth. Truth with a lowercase t, not a capital T. But, you know, if we're not going to get closer to the truth and understand more about the human condition, what are we doing in history anyhow?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So one last question. Since our show is about libraries and research, I wonder if you could just mention what libraries or archives you worked in. And you've spent a lot of your life, I expect, over the years in what Jules Michelet once termed those catacombs of manuscripts and parchments known as the French National Archives.
Well, I've spent a great deal of time in the French National Archives.
Yeah.
They move around, actually. They're no longer in the heart of Paris. When I spent most of my time there, they were in this wonderful section of Paris, the Marais, in a very beautiful building, and that you're surrounded by history in the architecture as well as manuscripts.
Yeah, that was the Hotel de Soubise, I think, or the Hotel de Rouen. There were two big chateaus.
Two connected, the Soubise-Rouen. I've also spent a huge amount of time in a very small library in French Switzerland, the town of Neuchâtel, which has the only surviving archives of a publisher from the 18th century. 50,000 letters about all aspects of the book, from the way books were printed and the way the paper was made and the ink to who the authors were and how they were smuggled or transported around and the whole world of the printed word. So I've spent 14 summers and one winter in this tiny little municipal archive in a small city or town of Switzerland, where I just absorbed as much from the archives as I possibly could. And it's difficult to explain the love of the archives. And it's hard work, but it's so enjoyable. And there is this sense of making discoveries and especially of being in contact with lives that were lived 200 or 300 years ago. It's a sort of exhilaration at getting to know other people who have something to say to us but who have been lost in the past, as most lives have.
You actually name in the book many, many people, you know, individuals. It's an interesting way of doing history. And it reminds me of Jules Michelet himself breathing in the dust of the archives in order to bring alive again the lives of the people he found buried
there.
Yes,
Michelet is a great source of inspiration, even for the most avant-garde historians in the so-called School of the Annales in Paris.
Yeah.
Michelet, he wasn't just a romantic. I think he was a great historian who had this deep vision of the human condition and managed to communicate it. So that's where, at least, I get a lot of my own inspiration.
So I want to thank you, Professor Darnton, for taking the time to visit with us here on the Library Cafe.
Well, thank you for having me in your cafe. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's been wonderful and an honor. We've been talking with Robert Darnton, Carl H. Forsheimer, University Professor and Librarian of Harvard University, about his book, Poetry and the Police, Communication Networks in 18th Century Paris, published by Harvard University Press in 2010. Tune in next Wednesday when we'll be talking with Dan Cohen, Executive Director of the Digital Public Library of America, about its many programs. And the following week, we'll be talking with Roberta Schaefer, a Vassar graduate and associate librarian for library services at the Library of Congress, about librarianship as a profession and new and old roles of the Library of Congress in a changing information-driven world. If you missed today's interview, you can find a recording of it on our website, along with a listing of future interviews and recordings of past interviews at library-cafe.org. This has been the Library Cafe on WVKR 91.3 FM Poughkeepsie. I'm Thomas Hill. Thanks for listening.